It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've been hearing the grim labor statistics in the top of the hour news. Yesterday, the Labor Department reporting around 9 million people had filed for unemployment insurance over the past 2 weeks. While millions of people are laid off, another set of individuals work in industries that the nation collectively asks not to slow down. Now, these are our essential workers based on the Department of Homeland Security designated industries. They ensure that the hundreds of millions of people under social distancing or shelter in place orders can continue to live their lives. They are the people who ensure that food is in our grocery stores, clean water comes out of the faucet, that the lights turn on, that the trash gets picked up, that the news gets reported here on Iowa Public Radio, for instance. Also, critically, we continue to get the health care we need. Joined by Jennifer Shearer, the first half hour. She's director of the University of Iowa Labor Center. This is a labor center that's been around, I think, since 1951, if I'm correct there. The Labor Center conducts educational programming for workers and their organizations. So we thought we'd have Jennifer on to ask your questions about workers' rights, labor issues during this national health crisis. Jennifer Shearer, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks, Ben.
I'm going to give out that phone number if you have a question for Jennifer. Perhaps you've been put out of work. Perhaps you have some sort of different working conditions. You'd like to find out what are your rights in that case. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. By the way, we'll have an ER doctor joining us for the second half hour. Jennifer will hopefully be able to stay with us. So the second half hour, we'll be able to field medical questions about the COVID epidemic. But first of all, we're going to concentrate on labor issues. Let me just ask generally, Jennifer, what's it been like at your center the past couple of weeks?
So I work for one of the many employers that has mandated that all of us who can work from home do work from home. So I want to give a shout out to my incredible staff. I think I have some of the hardest working folks at the university on my team. And we've been just doing our best really to keep up with a lot of changes and a lot of challenges that workers are facing across the state. Try to get information out as broadly as we can. So I appreciate the opportunity to share that on the air as well. I would say we're getting a lot of questions and inquiries and concerns. Some of them break down into three primary categories, and one would be from that group of workers you mentioned. We have thousands and thousands of people who are still on the job in Iowa and who have health and safety concerns. Are we taking all the steps we can in our workplaces to protect people from exposure to the extent possible? And I would say the second category is the thousands of people who have been either laid off or dealing with temporary shutdowns or are losing some of their hours because of the pandemic. And so we've had a lot of changes to both state rules and then new federal unemployment programs beginning to roll out. And so I think the message on unemployment right now is, even if you thought in the past that you might not be eligible for unemployment, you should look into whether you might be now because of some changes that are being made on the federal level. And there's new information coming out as we speak about that. So people should definitely be aware that those eligibility requirements are changing and the benefits are being expanded as part of the really disaster relief efforts. And then the third category is people, trying to navigate how to take care of themselves and their families at this time and what kinds of leave options are available through their employer that might apply to this situation, or what kinds of emergency measures need to be taken right now to make sure people have the paid or unpaid leave that they need to be at home if they can't work. Mm-hmm. And there are also some federal changes in paid leave laws that are just being implemented this week as we speak. And so we're trying to make sure people are aware of those.
Your questions about your rights as a worker during this national health crisis, 1-866-780-9100. Jennifer Shearer with us, director of the University of Iowa Labor Center. So let's talk about that first issue, commonly asked question all around the protection of what are deemed our essential workers. Of course, we want to make sure those in healthcare, those are probably the ones who have to be the most careful in this. So what else can you say about the protection of our workers, especially, you know, as a worker, whether you're in healthcare, whether you're delivering packages, whether you're, working in a grocery store, what rights do you have? When can you say, wait a minute, I don't feel good about this situation? How should you evaluate that?
So what we are doing is sharing the guidance that exists right now from both the CDC, Center for Disease Control, and from federal OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Both of those federal agencies have really fairly clear guidelines on best practices for employers to take right now. And what we're doing is trying to put those in workers' hands if they have concerns and say, all of us are, as a society, trying to deal with something that we don't have time, to wait around for long decision-making processes right now. And so I think a lot of workers, in some cases, if they're covered by a union, they're having, more formal discussions with the employer about steps that need to be taken quickly. If they're not covered by a union, then it's getting the information together and looking through it and saying, based on our workplace situation, what are the most important steps to take? In the world of occupational safety and health, we always talk about a hierarchy of controls. I mean, the best, the top of that hierarchy right now would be shutting down, right? I mean, the ideal safety protection in a context like this is to try not to expose people to each other at all. And we certainly have some employers who have been able to take that step. The next on the hierarchy would be, what are things we can do to prevent exposure through better ventilation, through physical barriers, through changing the work process so that people aren't in proximity to each other. And then next down on the list are things that are called administrative controls. And that's all the hand washing that we hear about and the sanitation and providing everybody with access to the right materials to do that, along with training for everybody so that they know how to do it as completely and thoroughly as possible. Some of those controls also involve changing policies, and that means actively encouraging people to stay home if they're sick. In some cases, we've seen employers changing attendance policies and saying, you're not going to be disciplined right now if you don't show up. We're going to waive the requirement for doctor's notes because the priority is public health, right? And that means that the priority has to be employee health. And implementing all kinds of practices depending on the workplace, whether that means staggering shifts, so there aren't as many people in the same facility at the same time, staggering lunch times, or there are all kinds of things people can take from that OSHA and CDC guidance and apply in their local context.
Jennifer Shearer of the University of Iowa Labor Center with us this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Spencer, Iowa. Clinton is with us in Spencer. Hi. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Not bad. Actually, on my way to work.
Oh, you are?
I am.
You're an essential worker.
I work for Walmart in Northwest Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of my biggest concerns is they've implemented some new stuff for us employees that, if we are sick, we get 2 weeks paid off, with the quarantine period. We also get the ability to take the time off even if we're not sick, if we have like a family member who's sick at home. My concern is that's not paid. So, I mean, I'm uncomfortable going to work as it is anyway right now, because I don't see the restrictions that have been put in place being followed at all. I mean, we still get groups of families showing up shopping. We still get people who are, coughing or sneezing, showing up, shopping like it's normal every day. And with a high-risk child myself at home, I play roulette with my health every day I go to work. But in the end, I don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. I have to work. I need to get paid. I have bills. I have car payments. I have rent. So my problem is when is enough enough, and is there anything there to help me if I decide that I just can't do it anymore?
Okay, Clinton and Spencer, wow, what a situation. Wish you and your family all the best, and certainly sympathize with wanting to provide for the family, but at the same time, not endangering you or other members of your family. What do you say to that, Jennifer? What advice?
Well, I just want to say first that this is the heartbreaking story that we are hearing over and over and over again from people all over our state right now. And I just want to send out my admiration and respect for people who are going to work on the front lines in every occupation, whether it's retail or factory work or healthcare or letter carriers right now, delivery drivers. They are making exactly that choice that our caller just articulated every day between, I've got to have paycheck to support myself and my family. I also want to protect my health, and I'm making a terrible choice every time I go into work between those two things. I wish I had a better answer for the caller. And I think what we're dealing with right now is we do have a new federal paid leave law that just went into effect. It sounds to me our caller works for a very large national global corporation, right? And it sounds like they have adopted something that's very parallel to what's in that paid leave law, which is providing up to 2 weeks of paid sick leave to people who need it because of the pandemic. Now, the new federal paid leave law goes beyond that and also offers up to 10 weeks of partially paid leave to people who need to be at home to care for their children while schools and daycares are closed right now. But that law exempted any employer that has fewer than 500 employees. So I'm also getting a lot of, heartbreaking questions and concerns from workers who are finding out they're not covered by that right now. And I'm afraid, we have large, large groups of workers who aren't going to be able to access that because of that exemption. We also know that all of these changes are unfolding as we speak. We're seeing instances of workers around the country who are taking forward proposals based on exactly the kinds of concerns we heard from our caller and getting, in some cases, some limited success in changing policies, getting some new agreements with their local employers about what they need to offer right now to make sure people still feel comfortable coming into work, both in terms of change in health and safety protocols and in terms of knowing they're going to have the leave they need when they need it to stay attached to that employer. We're also still seeing state and federal laws change as we speak by the day, and those debates are ongoing. So I would just also encourage people to be part of that process, both on the local level and the state and federal level.
Okay, more questions for Jennifer Shearer of the University of Iowa Labor Center. Let's go to an email from Robin, one of our listeners. Robin asks, will employees who have applied and been approved for state unemployment automatically receive the extra federal $600 in funds, or do they have to apply for the federal $600 in some other way? Do you know the answer to that, Jennifer?
Yeah, my understanding, so all unemployment claims are still going to go through the same process with the state agency, and that's Iowa Workforce Development. They have new information, detailed information coming out on their website every day. So there will not be, my understanding from them is there will not be a separate process of applying for the extra $600. This is part of the federal legislation just passed. And that the challenge with the extra $600 at this point is just that nobody knows exactly when those funds are going to get released from the federal level. And they're already telling people that it may be several weeks, but that funding will be retroactive. So even if somebody was unemployed starting this past week, right after the law was passed, if they've already filed their claim, they've already been drawing unemployment from the state of Iowa, that $600 will be applied retroactively to the claim they've already filed. That's my understanding. And I would encourage anybody who's filing or needs to consider filing for unemployment to check out all the information on the Iowa Workforce Development site.
One of our listeners, Deborah, writes that she's 71 years old, lives with her son. He works construction every day. And Deborah wants to know Are construction workers essential workers? We had another question as well, from a Don. Why is it an essential service to be in the construction trades? I cannot understand why drywall is critical. Any insights there, Jennifer? Of course, this is put out by Homeland Security, as I sort of outlined at the beginning, right? These are designated industries that need to keep running also in these times of crisis.
So I'm not certain that construction is categorized as an essential occupation. And it is, my understanding is it's even more complicated than that, that states are making their own designations about what is and is not essential. And then beyond that, employers in other industries, even if they're not on those essential lists, are making the decision whether they're going to stay open or keep up and running. Having heard from, I think a pretty good cross-section of folks who work in construction over the last couple weeks, I think we're seeing a range of responses. Some construction sites are up and fully running. Some are operating with fewer people on the job site. And some have shut down. So there really has been a range of responses.
Let's talk about a couple of the other aspects you've mentioned. Leave options. I don't know, what circumstances have you been hearing about there at the Iowa Labor Center that have led people? Give us an example of why someone may want leave at this time.
So let me share with you a couple of responses to a survey that the Iowa Federation of Labor put out a couple weeks ago, which I think just crystallized and humanized the situations people are in. Somebody who responded and said, I have a compromised immune system and a rare disease, but because I can't afford to stay home any longer, I have to go back to work. So people thinking about, I'm really a person who shouldn't be in the workplace or shouldn't be interacting with the public right now. And this is somebody who is in retail somebody who said, I'm not so much worried about myself as I am about taking sickness home to my 2-year-old son and wife who's 8 months pregnant. I obviously can't afford to just stay home, but at what point do I need to make that decision? And then I'll just share, one more question I got this morning before we spoke. It's fresh in my mind from a healthcare worker whose spouse works in manufacturing, and they are, trying to prepare and juggle the reality that at some point she clearly is in an essential occupation. She will have to continue working. Their daycare is only partially available now, and so they're trying to prepare for, will there be times where he is enabled to take leave from his manufacturing job to stay home while she's working her essential shift? So I think those are examples of all, some of the reasons people really need to have that kind of option right now.
Mm-hmm. And what rights do you have when you think leave is really the best option in your life?
So the basics are that first you should find out what your employer policy already is. In some cases, there may be some paid or unpaid leave options. Find that out first. Then if the fallback is what is the minimum of what the law requires, we do still have the Family Medical Leave Act in place, but that will only kick in once somebody is already ill. So it is not useful for all these situations, but it is there for those it covers once they have a serious health condition or if they're caring for somebody with a serious health condition. The new federal law, which I mentioned earlier, is intended to provide up to 2 weeks of paid sick leave. But again, the limitation there is only requiring employers with under 500 employees to provide that. So it does exclude a lot of people. Now, on the other hand, we are seeing that some employers are stepping up and offering at least that amount of leave to help our entire economy and our entire workforce and society deal with the situation. And I think we're also seeing, our collective expectations being elevated a little bit in this moment in hopes that more employers will step up and take on that obligation.
Before we go to break, we have a break in about 3 or 4 minutes, Jennifer. I wanted to ask you about working from home. Of course, a lot of us have been propelled into working from home. Some find that nice. Some find that wish they were back in their work atmosphere. Of course, I'm sure it's a mixed bag there. What What can you say about this transition now that many people are making to working from home? What are the chief labor issues you see when you transition to a home work environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I know that right now, particularly because I'm in the field of education, so many educators are struggling with, working harder than ever to try to connect with their students and in the K-12 world with the families that they serve. And so I want to give a shout out to them as well, while also, of course, juggling family obligations at home. Those are real challenges. And I think both with frontline workers who are still out there in essential occupations and people working at home, this pandemic is reminding us of something that was already true, which is the value of people's work and the way in which, most of the workers who are out on the front lines running the world today, we're often working in historically what were some very undervalued occupations with low wages. And so I think it's forcing us to think about what is our world going to look like? What is the whole world of work going to look like after this?
Right. And just to emphasize the last point you made in a very short amount of time, in many cases, we are calling some of the lowest paid people in our economy essential, right? They have to be out there, we say, and we as a society have been paying them quite low wages.
They were essential before they ever got that title, right? I think that's what I would say. And I think it's worth citing one of my wonderful colleagues from the University of Iowa, Colin Gordon, who put an essay out a week or two ago where he said, coronavirus is the inequality virus, right? It's affecting all of us, but it's clearly not affecting all of us in the same way. And the burden of exposure and risk and the, loss of income and the potential loss of health insurance for some folks, that is being borne by both the most vulnerable and in some cases the people whose work is most essential in keeping our world running right now.
Jennifer Shearer, please stay with us, Director of the University of Iowa Labor Center. Jennifer, you can stay with us, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, we'll have you in the second half hour as well, so please direct any of your workers' rights, labor questions, continue to our River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can also call us 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we hope to be joined by Dr. Nicholas Moore. He's an associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, also fielding your medical questions. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday, preempting our usual News Buzz edition. Because of the virus, we've been doing this the last couple of Fridays, is to field questions that have to do with the COVID-19 epidemic. This hour, we have Jennifer Shearer with us, Director of the University of Iowa Labor Center, giving us some very important information about workers' rights during this national health crisis. Jennifer is with us in this second half hour as well. Joining us this half hour is Dr. Nick Moore as well, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and Anesthesia Critical Care at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Dr. Moore, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
Now, you have a very busy schedule. You want to use your time well. So what are your questions, your medical questions for Dr. Nick Moore? 1-866-780-9100 or River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Moore, tell us a little bit about the what's been happening at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, how many COVID-19 patients, the discharges, the treatments. What overview can you give us?
Yeah, as you know, COVID-19 has come to our state and has affected a lot of the hospitals in Iowa. We've had patients who've been in the hospital at the University of Iowa for the last several weeks as we've kind of been responding to this epidemic here locally. We've had patients who have been critically ill requiring ventilators. We've had patients who have not been as sick, and we've also had patients who've now been discharged and gone home. So still a lot of preparation that has gone on for the last several months and weeks, and preparing for what is still to come.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe is still to come? What are you preparing for? Preparing for the worst, I assume, but hoping, of course, for the best. What is the worst case scenario you are preparing for?
Yeah, I think that along with all Iowa hospitals, we're preparing for an onslaught like what has been seen in other parts of the country. We hope that with social distancing, with people staying at home and being very careful about their social contacts, that that we can mitigate some of that here locally. But obviously, we're preparing to ramp up our crisis operations for surge capacity to be able to care for patients who need our services.
Right, and it's very important. We heard from a Walmart employee last half hour, still reporting families coming to shop. Do not go shopping as a family. Trim your shopping down to the bare minimum, what you need to get. Don't make it a daily occurrence if you can. And go send one person from your family to do all the shopping. Get in, get out. You're not only then keeping your life taking care of your own life, but who knows how many others. Dr. Moore, I mean, we have to pay attention to this. I wanted to go to an email from Mary in Des Moines. She just sent us. She reacted to the news she just heard. Also, that the Iowa Board of Medicine has recommended that the governor issue a stay-at-home order. Iowa, one of the handful of states that does not have a statewide stay-at-home order. Mary in Des Moines says a Des Moines doctor has started an online petition for doctors to ask the governor to issue a statewide stay-at-home. More than 2,000 doctors have already signed, she says. She wants to know if you agree.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that we really rely on our public health professionals in Iowa to make good decisions that will affect the health of our state. I think that from the perspective of healthcare at the University of Iowa, we recognize that the ability for people to stay at home and the importance of social isolation in reducing this outbreak is critical. We're preparing for what we really anticipate could be a surge of patients who are requiring health care in Iowa, and our ability to care for those people is really dependent upon everybody's efforts in decreasing the spread of this virus.
Mm-hmm. Explain a little bit more about the area that you're working in, the ICU there. Let's say I am infected with COVID-19. Take me along on that progression. What determines whether I come out of home care into the hospital, from the hospital to the ICU? What are you looking for in terms of the need to treat there?
That's a great question. COVID infection affects primarily people's ability to breathe. It affects their lung function. And for people who become sick with COVID, many patients can isolate at home and can allow their body's natural ability to heal to fight that infection. But there are people who develop enough injury to their lung just from the infection that they need to be on oxygen or they need to have some additional respiratory support. And that could even include a ventilator, and that's been in the news a lot lately. A ventilator is a machine that we use to help people breathe when they're not able to breathe on their own anymore. And so the criteria that we look for who needs to be in the hospital, it's people who need something that we can only give them in the hospital, which could be oxygen, it could be machines to help breathe for them. Patients come to the intensive care unit when either they need more advanced support for their breathing or when the inflammation from the infection causes them to have low blood pressure or problems with their heart function or other organ failure that requires organ support.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how many are on ventilators suffering from COVID-19 at the UI hospitals now?
I can't tell you how many patients we have on ventilators right now, but I can tell you that we have treated patients at the University of Iowa Hospital who have required ventilation support. Mm-hmm.
Are you confident that you have an adequate number of ventilators?
I think that that's a really good question because it depends on what this surge looks like. Right now, we're confident that we have the tools that we need to be able to care for the patients, certainly that we have now and that we're expecting, but a lot of that depends on people's social isolation to try to flatten out this curve.
Okay. We've been hearing that because elective surgeries are not taking place anymore, that some of that equipment from the surgery areas where elective surgeries would be performed, the ventilators there can be repurposed. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ben. The mechanical ventilator itself is a machine that, through delivering pressure and oxygen, can help to breathe for somebody when they're not able to breathe adequately on their own. And so we have ventilators that we use in the intensive care unit for patients who develop pneumonia or patients who've had surgery or patients who have trauma that we use in our intensive care units every day. We've developed here, and I think many hospitals have, surge capacity where if the need for ventilators exceeds the number of ventilators that we typically would have available in our intensive care units, we have some capacity for backup ventilators. We can use anesthesia machines as ventilators to be able to provide that mechanical ventilation support to patients who might need it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question from one of our listeners emailing. Heidi asks, would like to know about the near daily press conferences from the governor and the public health, reassuring Iowans that PPE, these are personal protective equipment, is being made available. And then her email goes on, for medical providers, nurses, doctors, PAs, et cetera, in hospital settings in Des Moines, the Des Moines metro area, Heidi writes, the reality is very different. Some doctors have acquired masks for hospital personnel at their own expense. We're already at the point where PPE is being rationed at one per day. I'm assuming that she means one mask per day. Employees in those settings are being told you will report to work even if sick. She goes on, finishes up, we have a limited supply of physicians and nurses, and hospitalized COVID-19 patients continue to rise. She thinks someone is not telling the truth here. I guess you can only give us the picture at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. What protection is there for the healthcare workers that you work with?
That's a good question, Ben. Right now we have a supply that's adequate to treat the patients that we have, but I think that everybody's concern is that we don't know what's coming. And we know that there are shortages nationally in being able to get new supply in. So we're very concerned about the supply chain for personal protective equipment. Right now, we have an adequate supply for what we're doing. We have gone to maximum conservation practices so that we go through fewer masks every day, so that we go through fewer face shields every day, so that we can conserve the equipment that we have for a surge of cases if they were to come, and we expect that there will be a surge of cases that are coming. So we have changed the operations in our hospital, and I think many Iowa hospitals have, to conserve what is available. We've also had donations from the community of face shields and masks, and we really appreciate that at the University of Iowa. But we're in kind of a mode of conservation here so that we can stretch the supply that we have for as long as we can.
Mm-hmm. To the point that Heidi made there, any healthcare provider that insists on an employee coming to work sick is just plain wrong. Can we say that?
Well, we certainly don't have patients who are, staff members who have COVID who are taking care of patients. So I think that right now is something that's not happening. The Department of Public Health has very clear guidelines on under what circumstances people should be staying home, and at the University of Iowa, we're following those state guidelines.
This has been, always looking for options here, how to treat patients, virtual care. I think it goes by telemedicine as well. To what extent is that growing? Is that being put to use?
Telemedicine is something that has been available throughout the state for quite some time, but certainly within the last few weeks, as the COVID outbreak has hit Iowa, has really expanded. Here we have a telemedicine clinic at the University of Iowa where we're seeing patients remotely so that we don't have patients who have illnesses that could be consistent with COVID or other influenza-like illnesses coming to the campus medical center. We are seeing patients remotely. In many cases, we're able to identify patients who need to be tested, and then we can bring them here for testing. But we're using telemedicine right now in many of our clinical spaces to try to reduce the number of patients that we need to have here on site at the University Hospital.
Dr. Nick Moore is with us, an ER doctor, associate professor of emergency medicine and anesthesia critical care at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, for the next 10 minutes or so. Also with us, Jennifer Shearer, director of the University of Iowa Labor Center, fielding your questions. I think this may be for both of you. Let me start off with Jennifer here. This is Tom from Sumner asking, are individuals who are working, say, at a grocery store able to apply for workers' compensation if they contract the disease? How can they prove they got it at work? Jennifer, I guess that would be very difficult to prove. If you run across...
So it may or may not be difficult to prove, depending on the context. So what I think the best information we can give people is what the current both health and safety guidelines and workers' compensation law says about that issue. So number one, if you believe you've contracted the virus at work, you should report it to your employer immediately. It is considered a reportable illness, a recordable workplace illness under OSHA, and employers are obligated by law to be tracking that. And then second, you may potentially be eligible for workers' compensation. I can't speak to that because, like any other workplace injury or illness, each case is going to be considered on a case-by-case basis. But if somebody contracts the illness and becomes incapacitated from work because of contracting it in the course of their employment, it's very possible that it would be considered a workers' compensation case.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Dr. Moore, anything to add to that?
No, I think that that's accurate. It's important for patients or community members who think that they have the illness that they're reporting it to their employer so that they're not continuing to propagate the spread of the virus.
Mm-hmm. Meredith online asked a question about the governor wanting the governor to have stricter regulations, but more in depth, Meredith is talking about people in parks, cyclists, she says cyclists are a major threat who don't keep their distance. Dr. Moore, tell us about this virus. I mean, you're in the park. We've all been in parks since the onset of this virus, this epidemic, and, you know, some steer very clear of the others. What is this capable, what is this virus capable of doing in terms of going a distance to get to another person? A passing cyclist could infect you?
That's a really good question. This virus is spread by droplets, and those are droplets that people spread when they're coughing or sneezing. Also, can be spread by contact with things that have been around other people. So, if you are alone and there's nobody around, and you're out in the in nature with nobody around you, then you don't have to worry so much about contracting the virus. But what we worry about in parks or in other places where people congregate is that as people walk through these spaces and sneeze, and people, pass each other on sidewalks, that we have some of that closer contact. We also worry about surfaces for, in stores or in other places where somebody walks by and sneezes or coughs and then has virus that's deposited on a surface. That's one of the reasons it's so important that we're washing our hands and that we aren't touching our faces, because this virus obviously can infect us by inhaling those droplets, but also by touching our eyes or our nose or our mouth and then being infected through mucous membrane exposure.
Mm-hmm. Another scenario I saw the other day, doctor, kids playing out, half a dozen kids playing together, rough and tumble. The weather's getting nice. This is what kids should do in normal times. What do you think of a scene like that? Half a dozen kids playing with each other, playing ball, bumping into each other and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a great question. A lot of those activities, formal organized activities in Iowa, now have been canceled. And the reason is because we're trying to isolate our social networks. I know that a lot of people are less concerned if they're young and healthy or children about contracting the illness and becoming critically ill from it. But what still happens is that those modes of transmission start to connect our social networks. Even if you and I, Ben, aren't in the same space, if our children see each other, or our friends see each other, now your social network and my social network can be connected, and that's how this virus propagates through a population. So really important that we limit those social interactions that, wrestling outside with kids from all over the neighborhood now connects all of those families of those children together and can help the virus to propagate.
Right. I had another experience yesterday out walking my dog. A young girl, I think of 4 or 5, came running up. She was way ahead of her parents, and she wanted to pet the dog. That happens often. I said, please stay away. I don't think your parents would want you to do that. The parents caught up with her and thanked me for having her not pet the dog. So my dog, a dog of a person who is infected with COVID virus, that coat could have the virus on it.
Yeah, with any object, if the virus has settled onto an object and then somebody comes by a few minutes later and touches that object, that can transmit the disease.
Mm-hmm. An email from Kevin, and I just went through the checkout line at a major grocery chain. I asked the cashier why no one is wearing masks or gloves. This person answered, quote, because management said we will scare people. Kevin asks, how can this be allowed? So this gets us to we've had a lot of confusion, haven't we, over masks and gloves, the proper use, who should be using them. What can you say to that, Dr. Moore?
Yeah, the CDC guidelines still are not recommending widespread mask use. Those guidelines can continue to evolve, and I don't know what the final determinations will be for that, but I think that what we know right now is that if you're ill, you shouldn't be out in public. It's really important, especially for people who have symptoms or who have been exposed, that they're not spreading the virus. We know that there are people who may be able to spread the virus even when they're not symptomatic, so reducing that social exposure is really, really important. And the other thing that is important is that we're trying to conserve personal protective equipment for people who are at high risk of exposure and for healthcare workers.
Mm-hmm. On that point that you talked about, you can have no symptoms and still be a carrier. Do we know, the profile of this new coronavirus is emerging day by day, researchers around the world working on it. What about that aspect of it? Do we know how many carriers there are who are just, they don't know, others don't know, they're not symptomatic?
We don't know that right now. There are certainly a number of groups that are trying to find the answers to those questions. But we know that there are people who are able to spread virus after they have been infected who have minimal symptoms or have no symptoms at all. And those people may go on a few days later to develop symptoms, or we think right now that they may not. So we don't know how many people in our community could be shedding virus. Right now, that's the edge of our knowledge, and it's something that that we'll know more probably in the next few weeks.
Dr. Nick Moore, ER, medical doctor and professor at the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine. We know you're in high demand at this time. We appreciate you giving us some advice and all the work that you're doing to help so many people, I'm sure.
Well, thank you for having me today. I just want to highlight what you have done so effectively in encouraging people to continue to socially isolate and continue to stay home, because I think that without therapy right now, a specific virus-targeted therapy, that's really what we can do for the people of Iowa, not just for ourselves, but as we stop the spread of this disease and protect the vulnerable among us.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Moore, before you go, you said the surge is coming. Do you know when the surge is coming to Iowa?
We don't know, and one of the reasons that we don't know that is because all of the estimates and projections assume some kind of public behavior. We know that that looks different if we start to open our churches and schools. We know that that looks different if people effectively isolate and reduce their trips to the grocery store and to Walmart. And so we're hoping that all of those changes that Iowans have made to their lives to try to stop the spread of the virus is effective, and that that will change when this surge comes and how big it is. But it depends on how we act, and it's really important, I think, that we all take that seriously as we try to reduce the spread of this disease.
Dr. Nick Moore, thank you once again.
Great. Thanks for having me, Ben.
And Jennifer Shearer, if you're still there, I wonder if you could spend just a few seconds to tell people we had far too many aspects to cover in terms of workers' rights here. And it's changing, as you mentioned, too. Laws are changing. Guidelines are changing. Where do you go to find out the latest information if you have a question about workers' rights?
So people can access our fact sheets that we've been putting out for Iowa workers, laborcenter.uiowa.edu, at the bottom of our page. Click where it says Iowa worker rights during COVID-19. That'll get you the up-to-date information on unemployment and links to the places where you need to go to file for unemployment. It'll get you the basics of what's happening in changes to leave and paid leave, and the basics on guidance on health and safety, and links to the places where you need to go if you need more detail on each of those three topics. And then they can email us if they've got further questions.
Okay, and find with your browser the University of Iowa Labor Center. Jennifer Shearer is its director. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Thank you so much for all the questions today. We'll be answering more, I assume, next Friday. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.